Welcome to the Voice of Truth on 103.3 WAJR-FM, the radio broadcast ministry of Christian Apostolic Church in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And now, your host, author, teacher, and pastor, Doug Joseph.
Welcome to the Voice of Truth. This is Pastor Doug Joseph, and my special guest today is Reverend John F. Harrison. And Brother Harrison, it is so good to have you with us, and you have made the long drive to come down and be with us all the way from Massachusetts. And that's one of those hard-to-pronounce state names that gets butchered so often.
Thank you for saying it right.
I had one high school teacher that really stressed to us how to say that state name properly, and I've never forgotten it. He was a very interesting teacher. He also told us the origin of the American phrase, okay, which is the presidential campaign of Martin Van Buren. His nickname was Old Kinderhook.
How about that?
OK for short. There are several theories for how OK came about, but that's the, and of all the competing theories, it's the one thought to be the most likely and the one that makes sense historically wise. And so, but little tidbits from high school, can you believe it? I still remember them.
I'd never heard that, but I'm glad I did, because it's one of those words I've always wondered about, because in every language, you hear people conversing on the phone in Korean or Chinese or Russian, at some point in the conversation, they will say, okay.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered why.
Yeah. We, the other night, my wife and I watched a video of some movie. I can't even remember now what it was, but there was a character in there, and this person was an Oriental character for whom you couldn't even say that English was a second language. He did not know any English. He really only knew two words of English, and it was yes and okay. So every time something would happen, he would say, okay, yes. So I did want to start off by giving a plug for your awesome novel, Fighting Back. And you have such a refreshing writing style. It's kind of fluey and yet gritty at the same time. And tell the folks, what genre or what category would you put your novel, Fighting Back, in?
That's an interesting question, because the answer almost depends on what day you ask me. I used to be one of those people that hated going to a bookstore and you'd pull a novel off the shelf and it would say, let's call it Autumn Leaves. Autumn Leaves, a novel. And that always annoyed me, because I thought to myself, well, I'm in the fiction section. It's a 100,000-word book. I know it's a novel. But now I understand better why they do that, because as soon as you slap a genre on it, it's suspense or it's mystery or it's whatever, then there are really hard and fast expectations that people have. I read a blog post by a famous novelist who writes suspense stories, and that's what I first thought Fighting Back was a suspense novel. And he explained that in that genre, you need to have a plot turn basically every four pages. And I'm thinking, well, I don't really do that. There's some nice twists in there, but not that frequent.
Yeah.
And so now what I tell people when they ask me, what kind of book is it? I say, well, it's got some action. It's got some suspense. It's got a little bit of romance. It's got theology. It's got ecclesiology. If I could sum it up in a nutshell, I would say if C.S. Lewis had written the Jack Reacher novels, that would be this book.
That is a great way to put it. You know, one of the funniest stories about my mother and my wonderful late mother, I was reminded of it when you talked about someone saying that the suspense novel should have a major development every four pages. For me, reading that type of thing is a little bit like being unwillingly strapped into a 150-mile-an-hour street police chase. You know, it's almost like too fast to even absorb it. My mother loved roller coasters, and what finally took her on to the Lord was a third bout of lymphoma. And the first bout of lymphoma, a knot rose up and went away on its own. The doctor said that it's very slow, it's not aggressive, we're not going to treat it, and then it went away on its own. The second bout was more aggressive, and they treated it and felt like they did their best to get it under control. And then not long after that, she was found to have it roaring back again for a third bout. And by this time, due to her age and her diminished health, the doctor said, I don't really think you're up for trying to fight at this time. And she said, I'm not up for trying to fight at this time. But in between that second bout of chemo and radiation and second bout of lymphoma and that third bout, the family took her to a Disney World experience. And she was still frail, and she was wheeled around the park in a wheelchair, but she wanted to ride the roller coasters. And so here was my elderly, aged mother astounding the crowds at Disney World because they would wheel her up in the wheelchair. Then she would stand up feebly, and they would help her over into the roller coaster, and she would ride the roller coaster.
Wow.
And so she told the story, and I can't remember the name of it, but there's a roller coaster at Disney World that it's based on some rock and roll band, and it's the fastest, most neck-breaking thing. That novel that you mentioned that just does something every four pages, this is the roller coaster equivalent of it.
Oh, boy.
And, I mean, it just pins you back in the seat and then jerks you, just practically breaks your neck. And after that one was over, and the intriguing thing was at the end of every roller coaster ride, one of her grandsons would shout, "Grandma made it!" And the whole crowd would cheer. And so when she got off this one, he screamed, "Grandma made it," and they all cheered. But she said, I leaned over and through gritted teeth, I mentioned, whispered to one of my family members, "I did make it, but I'll not be doing that again." Tell us a little bit about what the novel Fighting Back is about.
It's two story arcs in one. There's a what I call the physical plot, the physical narrative, which finds our protagonists through seemingly random chance running up against a very dangerous set of people that he happens to have a bit of an altercation with. And there is quite a bit of fallout from that altercation. And the physical plot is basically how he deals with all the challenges that come into his life as a result of that. There's also a spiritual arc in the story, and it's his character development. He is actually a character in a Bible parable. And I wanted to illustrate a parable. It's one that everyone has heard of, but I think most people maybe don't understand as well as they think they do. And so I wanted to provide some fictional backstory for the character. The parable is the parable of the prodigal son. And I wanted to provide some backstory. When I read the parable in the Bible, and it begins with the prodigal, the youngest son, leaving, my first thought was, well, why did he do that? And so I wanted to build in some backstory that would supply an answer for why he left. That's the physical plot covers some of that. And then take it from there. So his fall and recovery are the spiritual arc in the story. And so it's really carrying both of those lines at once.
I know that there's some pretty impacting commentary in there about human trafficking. Are there really businesses that are dealing with trafficked people in terms of like average city USA and, you know, suburbs, or is that just a fictional construct?
Unfortunately, that's real life. And in almost every city and decent sized suburb in the country, this goes on. In researching it, I was amazed to discover that there's a section of New York City, Flushing, New York, that serves as the primary entry point for trafficked people, primarily from Asian countries, China and Thailand primarily. And from there, they are literally fanned out across America and Canada. And back in the days when sites like Craigslist had personal ads, services that they don't advertise anymore, in every city you could see dozens of these kind of businesses that, to the person walking down the street, it looked like a normal, everyday business, but in many cases is a front for human trafficking and illicit services. And if the book can call attention to the existence of those things in the towns of the readers, then I think it will have done an enormous service, no matter how much they like the story.
Wow. You know, I mentioned earlier that your writing style has a wonderful fluidity to it, and yet also a grittiness. And Fighting Back, you kind of push the envelope a bit in terms of realism compared to what is generally found in Christian books. And I know I feel like I can always tell when a writer has written either from their own experience or has written from great research. And I kind of got the feeling that Fighting Back was a good mixture of both. I understand you have some background with some martial arts training.
I do. And I did draw on that in some of the fight scenes in the book. I went to my longtime martial arts instructor. He's one of the people who helped create MMA before mixed martial arts was a term, and is trained with world famous people and is quite well known in that community. And I went to him and choreographed the fight scenes and actually fought through them.
Wow.
To make sure they worked, because nothing annoys me more than reading something in an area where I have some knowledge and it's clear that the author did not. You know, they'll say something about, let's say, a firearm that just couldn't be true with the firearm they're talking about. You know, the thumb of safety on a Glock. Well, it doesn't have one, you know. And so I wanted to make sure that if any experienced fighters, for instance, were reading the book, they wouldn't roll their eyes and go, okay, that wouldn't happen. So we actually choreographed the fight scenes and made sure they worked in real life.
Now, some of those aspects, like the fighting scenes and things with self-defense, that's kind of a little bit what we mean of like kind of like pushing the envelope on what's generally seen in a Christian novel. And did you have any concern about possibly offending some of your readers? And where did you come down on where you drew the line on that kind of thing?
It was scary. And I did worry about maybe offending people, because I know that in most Christian novels, I put them in the realm of fantasy in my mind, because in most of them, no one does or says or thinks anything that the reader or the reader's pastor wouldn't approve of.
Yeah.
I remember reading one Christian novel years ago that featured a drug cartel. And the soldiers, the enforcers in this drug cartel, were ordered to eliminate some witnesses. And because there were minors among the witnesses, they said, in essence, wow, we can't do that. And I thought to myself, I'm not sure that's how these cartel enforcers would talk. If they sound like Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
And so I wanted it to be believable.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go as far in that direction as I could without crossing the line into being crass or vulgar or anything like that. But I definitely wanted it to be more real than many of the Christian books I've seen. I did worry a little bit about how it would be perceived. I won't say violent scenes, but there are some fight scenes, and there is some violence in the book. And also some of the places that our prodigal goes while he's far from home, I worried that people would. So one of the things that I did was I sent a copy of the finished manuscript to a preacher friend who is about 2 decades older than me and very conservative, and I sweated. And I thought to myself, okay, maybe this is going to cost me the, you know. And he wrote back and said that he loved it. He said there were things that made him a little angry at first. He said, but in the end, he thought it was a great book. And he's been sort of boosting the book ever since.
Wow.
In ways that really surprised me. So that it really helped to know that context, I guess, is everything. If someone writes something that is gratuitously this or that, that's offensive. But if people understand that, you know, you're taking a realistic look at what happens to people. And the first sentence of the book actually prepares the reader for what's coming. The very first sentence is, on the spur of the moment, Eddie Carruthers decided to help a damsel in distress, and thus began his long slide into darkness. So there are no surprises in terms of where he's going.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a bit grittier than most books in this genre.
Yeah.
But I think that as long as the reader is an adult, it's not a problem.
You know, you mentioned the word gratuitous, and I think that that is a horrific problem with most Hollywood movies. And the concept is that they start off from what sounds like a reasonable standpoint, which is what you mentioned a minute ago, that they don't want to make a thug sound like a Boy Scout, so they think that to be realistic. The thing is, though, as a reader of a novel or as a viewer of a video that I've purchased, I don't believe that realism has to be an unedited realism. And I don't assume that the thug speaks like a Boy Scout, and I don't assume that the thug doesn't speak profanities every other word. So, but I would want the edited version, not the tweaked so that it's unrealistic. Don't give me a Boy Scout version of the thug. Just give me the edited version of the thug.
Exactly.
And this is really, I've found some tools and some tricks for being able to basically edit on my own. There's a, for some of our viewers that would benefit from this, there is a plugin, free plugin for Google Chrome, that if you're watching something on Netflix, for instance, which, by the way, we dumped Netflix after, you know, they had multiple horrific things in a row, the 13 Reasons series, which I've never watched any of, but so glorifies suicide that they actually had young viewers committing suicide after having watched the series. And then there was the whole fiasco with Cuties, where they take these underage, they take these girls and basically sexualize these girls in this series. And so there's been a mass exodus from Netflix. But this plugin works with that service, and it may work with other services in which you can set it. And as you watch through the browser, it basically filters out bad language for you as you go. One other thing I wanted to mention was that your portrayal of the local church was treated a little differently than Christian novels normally do. And what was that, a deliberate choice, or what was your thinking behind that?
Yes, there's two things I wanted to do with the local church. I know that in many Christian novels, the church is sort of there in the background, but it does not feature prominently in the plot. It's sort of understood that the Christian protagonist goes to a church. It's usually a very generic name because they don't want to pick a particular denomination or anything like that.
Yeah.
I wanted to be very specific and be realistic in the sense that for many Christians, church is a central part of their lives.
Exactly.
And so they go there regularly, and they would consult with spiritual leadership on important decisions, and they would, you know, pray and read the Bible and factor that into their decision makings. I wanted all that to sort of be front and center. I also wanted to show the church the good, the bad, and the ugly of the local church that this character belonged to. Too often we get the sort of Norman Rockwell postcard portrayal of a local church. It's just this wonderful little building full of eternally happy people yeah. who never have any conflict with each other. And I've yet to meet the Christian whose life experience matches that portrait.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to actually show that there can be problems in a church, and they can be big problems, and what do you do when that happens, and how do you work through it,
yeah.
that sort of thing. It was all part of the general, going back to your early question, the grittiness of it. I didn't want to sugarcoat anything, whether it was yeah. what the prodigal was doing or what was going on in the church. And as I think about it, it was particularly important to me to do that with the character as he left the church and began to have his long slide into darkness, because the biblical parable, the prodigal son, is an illustration of the grace of the father in receiving his son when he returns. And I thought to myself, you know, if the worst thing this guy ever does in the book is miss a few synagogue services, then the grace isn't all that amazing.
Yeah.
And so I also wanted, because the parable in the Bible features two brothers, the prodigal and an elder brother, I wanted to give people the opportunity to check themselves for any of the elder brother spirit. How mad at the lead character are you going to get? Are you?
That is a great point.
So I try to mix all of those reasoning in.
You know, there was one occasion when a church member that was over the top, out of control, abusively abrasive, really without any proper basis, just really letting me have it right during a church service. It was actually, you know, in just in a room just adjacent to the sanctuary. It was overheard, and I had to step out of that and then come to the pulpit and preach. And so one of the people that overheard it said, boy, I have a whole new level of appreciation for you after that. The just at our most recent church service, we had, and you know, various families in our church have been through horrific problems and spiritual battles and emotional battles. And our church as a whole is kind of coming out of a whole perfect storm conglomerate of challenges and problems. But just in our most recent church service, I said in the microphone to the church, I said, just because we are exuberant in giving praise to God does not mean that we don't have difficulties. And it is, in fact, that praise that you get from that God gets even in the midst of the difficulties that really has value. And I made reference to that scripture verse that talks about the sacrifice of praise. It's when the fruit of our lips gives praise to his name, when emotionally speaking, we don't maybe wouldn't feel particularly motivated to praise.
Yes.
And David mentioned at one point that he would not offer to the Lord that which didn't cost him anything. And I think sometimes the praise that we give that comes in the midst of I'm not praising because I feel like it. I'm not praising because everything is wonderful. I'm not praising because I haven't been in a challenge or because our church hasn't been through a struggle. That's the praise that I think is the most authentic and the most needful. You mentioned that you sent it to the one conservative preacher that had a couple of decades on you and the reaction you got from him. What other reactions have you gotten from the novel Fighting Back?
A really wide range of them, all of them supportive. I imagine there must be someone who didn't like it, but they didn't respond to me. But two of them really stick out in my mind, two responses. One was from a reader at an employer's book club, and this was not someone affiliated with the church, and someone who told me prior to reading it that he didn't like reading Christian books. And so I thought, oh boy. And after reading, he told me he loved it. He said, what struck me is so funny. It's a book that is laden with Christian content. There's an entire church service described in detail. It takes an entire chapter. There are Bible studies. There are discussions about Bible between various characters. There is the prayer life of the protagonist. All of that is in there. What's not in there is the thing that you normally see in Christian books, where there's an unbelieving character who gets evangelized as a proxy for the unbelieving reader. And the unbelieving reader knows this is coming and feels preached to and resents it. Well, Fighting Back doesn't do that. And so this person at the book club said, I really liked it. And, you know, it's not really a Christian book. It's, you know, it's the Christian characters and they do Christian things, but it's not one of those. And I just smiled because I'm like, wow, that's not really a Christian book. So I liked his reaction. And the other one was from a different preacher who, and again, when because one of the preachers portrayed in the book, I don't want to call him a bad guy, but he is one of the antagonists to our lead character. And because his portrayal is warts and all, I worried a little bit of how ministers would respond to the book. And this particular minister wrote me a short email that I printed and framed. And what he said was, I have seen the abuse. I may have been an abuser, and this book will make me a better man. I almost fell off my chair.
Wow.
And for him to have said that, been that vulnerable. I've seen the abuse. I may have been an abuser. This book will make me a better man.
Wow.
I couldn't ask for it. You can't print that on the back cover, but you can't ask for a better endorsement.
You know, one of the things, there's so many things that are so powerful about writing and then reading someone else's writing. And I don't know that I can quote it verbatim. And so this is, you know, probably the best I can get at a paraphrase. But someone said once, basically, that the writer is able to actually project their mind into the reader's mind for the time that they're reading that book. One of the most powerful things about a book is it allows us to, for a brief moment, step out of our shoes and step into someone else's shoes and learn lessons that we didn't have to learn in real life. We learned it through reading. And that ability to, you know, I think probably one of the most powerful things God has ever done for me in prayer was there was one occasion when the Lord took me out of myself and then showed me myself from other people's point of view. And it was devastating, but very powerful. But it sounds to me like that the Lord helped through your book to do that for that one minister. It allowed himself to see himself from someone else's shoes for at least a period of time, or at least in some aspect of his life.
And that one of the things that really, just to second what you're saying, is that I used to not be a big fan of fiction. My first book was a nonfiction book. I used to only read nonfiction as a younger person. And my wife actually converted me to being a fiction reader. And the saying she always said was, fiction tells the truth. And I never really understood what she meant by that until I wrote this particular book. And I realized you can say things in a fictional setting and people will listen to it that they would not listen to in a nonfiction book, because in nonfiction, you realize you are reading the words and thoughts of the author and you are tempted to argue with him. Whereas in a fiction book, you're simply reading what a character thinks. You're not going to argue with a fictional character.
Yeah.
And so you'll let the fictional character speak his mind or do what he wants to do or whatever, and you'll just observe it. And it lets you be open to that process you just described, seeing yourself from someone else's point of view in a way that even nonfiction generally can't. Yeah. And so it's been an exciting journey for me to realize this is a potentially powerful thing.
And I know some of our listeners may remember that that I've written both fiction and nonfiction. And in that regard, that's one of the things that you and I share in common. You've written both fiction and nonfiction. Some of your nonfiction has been about financial management, and we want to pivot to that in a bit. But with regard to your fiction writing, I don't know if maybe commiserate is the right word, but anyone who's ever tried to write knows that writing is hard.
Yes.
And so what's going on with regard to, is there a sequel? And if there is a sequel, what's your timetable on it?
There is, and I don't know if I should properly call it a sequel in that the story in Fighting Back starts and ends in Fighting Back. It's a complete tale. But there is a second book in that world coming. I guess we'd call it a series. And it's in the same general location. It features the people in the same church. A different lead character in the second book, which will be called Kindred Spirits. It's someone who was a bit player in Fighting Back is now the lead character, the antagonist in Kindred Spirits. So there's some overlap. There's some overlap in terms of the timeline. Kindred Spirits happens during the action of Fighting Back, just in a more compressed window. And while our lead character in Fighting Back is off doing what he's doing, then these events are going on back at the church.
Wow.
So there's actually even one chapter that overlaps.
That is so cool.
So I'm looking forward to it. Timeline, if you'd asked me a year ago, I'd have said it would come out this past July. But that was perhaps optimistic. I'm about 60% through the writing. And then it will, you know, go out to beta readers and be revised, and then we'll go to the editor, and then finally, you know, book cover designers and formatters and all of that. So now I'm hoping for spring, and I think it will be worth the wait. I think in many respects it's a better book than Fighting Back in that I've had more practice at this.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited for it. It's called Kindred Spirits.
Just being honest, I felt like that the three novels that I wrote, I felt like they got better with each one. But I felt like your first one was better than my third one.
Thank you for listening. You can reach us online at cac.us.com. Catch the Voice of Truth broadcast each Sunday morning at 11:30 right here on Talk Radio 103.3 WAJR-FM.